When he awakened, the sun was cooking the inside of his mouth and had dried his tongue to leather. He had fallen into a deeper sleep with his mouth open just at dawn, and it tasted as if he had been sucking on his foot all night. He rolled out and almost bellowed with pain from his ribs. They had tightened in the night and seemed to pull at his chest when he moved. He slowed his movements and stood slowly without stretching unduly and went to the lake for a drink. At the shore he kneeled, carefully and with great gentleness, and drank and rinsed his mouth. To his right he saw that the fish pond was still there, although the willow gate was gone and there were no fish. "They'll come back," he thought. "As soon as I can make a spear or bow and get one or two for bait, they'll come back." He turned to look at his shelter, saw that some of the wood for the wall was scattered around the beach, but was still there. Then saw his bow jammed into a driftwood log, broken but with the precious string still intact. Not so bad now. Not so bad. He looked down the shoreline for other parts of his wall, and that's when he saw it. Out in the lake, in the short part of the L, something curved and yellow was sticking 6 or 8 inches out of the water. It was a bright color, not an earth or natural color, and for a second he could not place it. Then he knew it for what it was. "It's the tail of the plane." He said it aloud, half expecting to hear somebody answer him. There it was, sticking up out of the water. The tornado must have flipped the plane around somehow when it hit the lake, changed the position of the plane, and raised the tail. Well, he thought, well, just look at that. And at the same moment, a cutting thought hit him. He thought of the pilot still in the plane, and that brought a shiver and massive sadness that seemed to settle on him like a weight. And he thought that he should say or do something for the pilot, some words, but he didn't know any of the right words, the religious words. So he went down to the side of the water and looked at the plane and focused his mind the way he did when he was hunting the fool birds and wanted to concentrate, focused it on the pilot and thought, "Have rest. Have rest forever." He turned back to his campsite and looked to the wreckage. He had a lot to do. Rebuild his shelter, get a new fire going, find some food, or get ready to find some food, make weapons, and he had to work slowly because his ribs hurt. First things first. He tried to find some dry grass and twigs, then peeled bark from a nearby birch to shred into a fire nest. He worked slowly, but even so, with his new skill, he had a fire going in less than an hour. The flames cut the cool, damp morning, crackled, and did much to bring his spirits up, not to mention chasing away the incessant mosquitoes. With the fire going, he searched for dry wood. The rain had driven water into virtually all the wood he could find, and at last located some in a thick evergreen where the top branches had covered the lower dead ones, keeping them dry. He had great difficulty breaking them, not being able to pull much with his arm or chest muscles, but finally got enough to keep the fire going all day and into the night. With that, he rested a bit, eased his chest, and then set about getting a shelter squared away. Much of the wood from his original wall was still nearby, and up in back of the ridge he actually found a major section of the weave still intact. The wind had torn it out, lifted it, and thrown it to the top of the ridge, and Brian felt lucky once more that he had not been killed or more seriously injured, which would have been the same, he thought. If he couldn't hunt, he would die, and if he were injured badly, he would not be able to hunt. He jerked and dragged wood around until the wall was once more in place, crudely, but he could improve it later. He had no trouble finding enough pine boughs to make a new bed. The storm had torn the forest to pieces. Up and back of the ridge it looked like a giant had become angry and used some kind of massive meat grinder on the trees. Huge pines were twisted and snapped off, blown sideways. The ground was so littered with limbs and treetops sticking every which way that it was hard to get through. He pulled enough thick limbs in for a bed, green and spicy with the new broken sap smell, and by evening he was exhausted, hungry, and hurting, but he had something close to a place to live again, a place to be. Tomorrow, he thought as he lay back in the darkness, tomorrow maybe the fish would be back and he would make a spear and new bow and get some food. Tomorrow he would find food and refine the camp and bring things back to sanity from the one completely insane day. He faced the fire. Curving his body, he rested his head on his arm and began to sleep when a picture came into his head. The tail of the plane sticking out of the water. There it was, the tail sticking up. And inside the plane, near the tail, somewhere, was the survival pack. It must have survived the crash because the plane's main body was still intact. That was the picture, the tail sticking up and the survival pack inside, right there in his mind as he dozed. His eyes snapped open. If I could get at the pack, he thought. Oh, if I could get at the pack, it probably had food and knives and matches. It might have a sleeping bag. It might have fishing gear. Oh, it must have so many wonderful things. If I could get at the pack and just get some of those things, I would be rich. So rich if I could get at the pack. Tomorrow. He watched the flames and smiled. Tomorrow I'll see. All things come tomorrow. He slept, deep and down, with only the picture of the plane tail sticking up in his mind. A healing sleep. In the morning he rolled out before true light. In the gray dawn he built up the fire and found more wood for the day, feeling almost chipper because his ribs were much better now. With camp ready for the day, he looked to the lake. Part of him half expected the plane tail to be gone, sunk back into the depths, but he saw that it was still there, didn't seem to have moved at all. He looked down at his feet and saw that there were some fish in his fish pen looking for the tiny bits of bait still left from before the wind came. He fought impatience to get on the plane project and remembered sense, remembered what he had learned. First, food, because food made strength. First food, then thought, then action. There were fish at hand here, and he might not be able to get anything from the plane. That was all a dream. The fish were real, and his stomach, even his new shrunken stomach, was sending signals that it was savagely empty. He made a fish spear with two points, not peeling the bark all the way back, but just working on the pointed end. It took him an hour or so, and all the time he worked, he sat looking at the tail of the plane sticking up in the air, his hands working on the spear, his mind working on the problem of the plane. When the spear was done, although still crude, he jammed a wedge between the points to spread them apart and went to the fish pond. There were not clouds of fish, but at least 10, and he picked one of the larger ones, a round fish almost 6 inches long, and put the spear point in the water, held it, then thrust with a flicking motion of his wrist when the fish was just above the point. The fish was pinned neatly, and he took two more with the same ease, then carried all three back up to the fire. He had a fish board now, a piece of wood he had flattened with the hatchet that leaned up by the fire for cooking fish, so he didn't have to hold a stick all the time. He put the three fish on the board, pushed sharpened pegs through their tails into cracks on the cooking board, and propped it next to the reddest part of the coals. In moments, the fish were hissing and cooking with the heat, and as soon as they were done, or when he could stand the smell no longer, he picked the steaming meat from under the loosened skin and ate it. The fish did not fill him, did not even come close. Fish meat was too light for that. But they gave him strength. He could feel it moving into his arms and legs, and he began to work on the plane project. While making the spear, he had decided that what he would have to do was make a raft and push paddle the raft to the plane and tie it there for a working base. Somehow he would have to get into the tail inside the plane, rip or cut his way in, and however he did it, he would need an operating base of some kind, a raft. Which, he found ruefully, was much easier said than done. There were plenty of logs around. The shore was littered with driftwood, new and old, tossed up and scattered by the tornado, and it was a simple matter to find four of them about the same length and pull them together. Keeping them together was the problem. Without rope or cross pieces and nails, the logs just rolled and separated. He tried wedging them together, crossing them over each other. Nothing seemed to work, and he needed a stable platform to get the job done. It was becoming frustrating, and he had a momentary loss of temper, as he would have done in the past when he was the other person. At that point, he sat back on the beach and studied the problem again. Sense. He had to use his sense. That's all it took to solve problems. Just sense. It came then. The logs he had selected were smooth and round and had no limbs. What he needed were logs with limbs sticking out. Then he could cross the limbs of one log over the limbs of another and weave them together as he had done his wall, the food shelf cover, and the fish gate. He scanned the area above the beach and found four dry treetops that had been broken off by the storm. These had limbs, and he dragged them down to his work area at the water's edge and fitted them together. It took most of the day. The limbs were cluttered and stuck any which way, and he would have to cut one to make another fit. Then cut one from another log to come back to the first one. Then still another from a third log would have to be pulled in. but at last, in the late afternoon, he was done, and the raft, which he called Brush Pile One for its looks, hung together even as he pulled it into the water off the beach. It floated well, if low in the water, and in the excitement he started for the plane. He could not stand on it, but would have to swim alongside. He was out to chest depth when he realized he had no way to keep the raft at the plane. He needed some way to tie it in place so he could work from it, and for a moment he was stymied. He had no rope, only the bowstring, and the other cut shoestring in his tennis shoes, which were by now looking close to dead, his toes showing at the tops. Then he remembered his windbreaker, and he found the tattered part he used for an arrow pouch. He tore it into narrow strips and tied them together to make a rope or tie-down about 4 feet long. It wasn't strong. He couldn't use it to pull a Tarzan and swing from a tree, but it should hold the raft to the plane. Once more he slid the raft off the beach and out into the water until he was chest-deep. He had left his tennis shoes in the shelter, and when he felt the sand turn to mud between his toes, he kicked off the bottom and began to swim. Pushing the raft, he figured, was about like trying to push an aircraft carrier. All the branches that stuck down into the water dragged and pulled, and the logs themselves fought any forward motion, and he hadn't gone 20 feet when he realized that it was going to be much harder than he thought to get the raft to the plane. It barely moved, and if he kept going this way, he would just about reach the plane at dark. He decided to turn back again, spend the night and start early in the morning, and he pulled the raft once more onto the sand and wipe-scraped it dry with his hand. Patience. He was better now, but impatience still grounded him a bit, so he sat at the edge of the fish pond with the new spear and took 3 more fish, cooked them up and ate them, which helped to pass the time until dark. He also dragged in more wood, endless wood, and then relaxed and watched the sun set over the trees in back of the ridge. West, he thought. I'm watching the sun set in the west. And that way was north, where his father was, and that way east, and that way south. And somewhere to the south and east his mother would be. The news would be on the television. He could visualize more easily his mother doing things than his father, because he had never been to where his father lived now. He knew everything about how his mother lived. She would have the small television on the kitchen counter on and be watching the news and talking about how awful it was in South Africa or how cute the baby in the commercial looked, talking and making sounds, cooking sounds. He jerked his mind back to the lake. There was great beauty here, almost unbelievable beauty. The sun exploded the sky, just blew it up with the setting color, and that color came down into the water of the lake, lit the trees. Amazing beauty, and he wished he could share it with somebody and say, "Look there, and over there, and see that." But even alone it was beautiful, and he fed the fire to cut the night chill. There it is again, he thought, that late summer chill to the air, the smell of fall. He went to sleep thinking a kind of reverse question. He did not know if he would ever get out of this, could not see how it might be. But if he did somehow get home and go back to living the way he had lived, would it be just the opposite? Would he be sitting watching television and suddenly think about the sunset up in back of the ridge and wonder how the color looked in the lake? Sleep. In the morning, the chill was more pronounced, and he could see tiny wisps of vapor from his breath. He threw wood on the fire and blew until it flamed, then banked the flames to last and went down to the lake. Perhaps because the air was so cool, the water felt warm as he waded in. He made sure the hatchet was still at his belt and the raft still held together, then set out pushing the raft and kick-swimming toward the tail of the plane. As before, it was very hard going. Once an eddy of breeze came up against him, and he seemed to be standing still. And by the time he was close enough to the tail to see the rivets in the aluminum, he had pushed and kicked for over 2 hours, was nearly exhausted, and wished he had taken some time to get a fish or two and have breakfast. He was also wrinkled as a prune and ready for a break. The tail looked much larger when he got next to it, with a major part of the vertical stabilizer showing and perhaps half of the elevators. Only a short piece of the top of the fuselage, the plane's body toward the tail, was out of the water, just a curve of aluminum, and at first he could see no place to tie the raft. But he pulled himself along the elevators to the end, and there he found a gap that went in up by the hinges where he could feed his rope through. With the raft secure, he climbed on top of it and lay on his back for 15 minutes, resting and letting the sun warm him. The job, he thought, looked impossible. To have any chance of success, he would have to be strong when he started. Somehow he had to get inside the plane. All openings, even the small rear cargo hatch, were underwater, so he couldn't get at them without diving and coming up inside the plane, where he would be trapped. He shuddered at that thought and then remembered what was in the front of the plane, down in the bottom of the lake, still strapped in the seat, the body of the pilot. Sitting there in the water, Brian could see him, the big man with his hair waving in the current, his eyes open. Stop, he thought. Stop now. Stop that thinking. He was nearly at the point of swimming back to shore and forgetting the whole thing, but the image of the survival pack kept him. If he could get it out of the plane, or if he could just get into it and pull something out, a candy bar. Even that, just a candy bar, it would be worth it. But how to get at the inside of the plane? He rolled off the raft and pulled himself around the plane. No openings. 3 times he put his face in the water and opened his eyes and looked down. The water was murky, but he could see perhaps 6 feet, and there was no obvious way to get into the plane. He was blocked. Brian worked around the tail of the plane 2 more times, pulling himself along on the stabilizer in the elevator, but there simply wasn't a way in. Stupid, he thought. I was stupid to think I could just come out here and get inside the plane. Nothing is that easy. Not out here, not in this place, nothing is easy. He slammed his fist against the body of the plane, and to his complete surprise, the aluminum covering gave easily under his blow. He hit it again, and once more it bent and gave, and he found that even when he didn't strike it but just pushed, it still moved. It was really, he thought, very thin aluminum skin over a kind of skeleton, and if it gave that easily, he might be able to force his way through. The hatchet. He might be able to cut or hack with the hatchet. He reached to his belt and pulled the hatchet out, picked a place where the aluminum gave to his push, and took an experimental swing at it. The hatchet cut through the aluminum as if it were soft cheese. He couldn't believe it. 3 more hacks and he had a triangular hole the size of his hand, and he could see 4 cables that he guessed were the control cables going back to the tail, and he hit the skin of the plane with a frenzied series of hacks to make a still larger opening, and he was bending a piece of aluminum away from 2 aluminum braces of some kind when he dropped the hatchet. It went straight down past his legs. He felt it bump his foot and then go on down, down into the water. And for a second he couldn't understand that he had done it. For all this time, all the living and fighting, the hatchet had been everything. He had always worn it. Without the hatchet he had nothing, no fire, no tools, no weapons. He was nothing. The hatchet was, had been, him. And he had dropped it. Ah! He yelled it. Choked on it, a snarl cry of rage at his own carelessness. The hole in the plane was still too small to use for anything, and now he didn't have a tool. That was the kind of thing I would have done before, he said to the lake, to the sky, to the trees. When I came here, I would have done that. Not now, not now. Yet he had. And he hung on the raft for a moment and felt sorry for himself, for his own stupidity. But as before, the self-pity didn't help, and he knew that he had only 1 course of action. He had to get the hatchet back. He had to dive and get it back. But how deep was it? In the deep end of the gym pool at school, he had no trouble getting to the bottom, and that was, he was pretty sure, about 11 feet. Here it was impossible to know the exact depth. The front end of the plane, anchored by the weight of the engine, was obviously on the bottom. But it came back up at an angle, so the water wasn't as deep as the plane was long. He pulled himself out of the water so his chest could expand, took 2 deep breaths and swiveled and dove, pulling his arms and kicking off the raft bottom with his feet. His first thrust took him down a good 8 feet, but the visibility was only 5 feet beyond that, and he could not see bottom yet. He clawed down 6 or 7 more feet, the pressure pushing in his ears until he held his nose and popped them, and just as he ran out of breath and headed back up, he thought he saw the bottom, still 4 feet below his dive. He exploded out of the surface, bumping his head on the side of the elevator when he came up and took air like a whale, pushing the stale air out until he wheezed, taking new in. He would have to get deeper yet and still have time to search while he was down there. Stupid, he thought once more, cursing himself, just dumb. He pulled air again and again, pushing his chest out until he could not possibly get any more capacity, then took 1 more deep lungful, wheeled, and dove again. This time he made an arrow out of his arms and used his legs to push off the bottom of the raft, all he had in his legs to spring, snap, and propel him down. As soon as he felt himself slowing a bit, he started raking back with his arms at his sides, like paddles, and thrusting with his legs like a frog, and this time he was so successful that he ran his face into the bottom mud. He shook his head to clear his eyes and looked around. The plane disappeared out and down in front of him. He thought he could see the windows, and that made him think again of the pilot sitting inside, and he forced his thoughts from it, but he could see no hatchet. Bad air triggers were starting to go off in his brain, and he knew he was limited to seconds now, but he held for a moment and tried moving out a bit, and just as he ran out of air, knew that he was going to have to blow soon, he saw the handle sticking out of the mud. He made one grab, missed, reached again and felt his fingers close on the rubber. He clutched it and in one motion slammed his feet down into the mud and powered himself up. But now his lungs were ready to explode and he had flashes of color in his brain, explosions of color, and he would have to take a pull of water, take it into his lungs, and just as he opened his mouth to take it in, to pull in all the water in the lake, his head blew out of the surface and into the light. Shock! It was as if a balloon had exploded. Old air blew out of his nose and mouth, and he pulled new in again and again. He reached for the side of the raft and hung there, just breathing until he could think once more, the hatchet clutched and shining in his right hand. All right. The plane. Still the plane. He went back to the hole in the fuselage and began to chop and cut again, peeling the aluminum skin off in pieces. It was slow going because he was careful. Very careful with the hatchet. But he hacked and pulled until he had opened a hole large enough to pull his head and shoulders in and look down into the water. It was very dark inside the fuselage and he could see nothing. Certainly no sign of the survival pack. There were some small pieces and bits of paper floating on the surface inside the plane, dirt from the floor of the plane that had floated up, but nothing substantial. Well, he thought, did you expect it to be easy? So easy that way, just open her up and get the pack, right? He would have to open it more, much more, so he could poke down inside and see what he could find. The survival pack had been a zippered nylon bag, or perhaps canvas of some kind, and he thought it had been red, or was it gray? Well, that didn't matter. It must have been moved when the plane crashed, and it might be jammed down under something else. He started chopping again, cutting the aluminum away in small triangles, putting each one on the raft as he chopped. He could never throw anything away again, he thought, because they might be useful later. Bits of metal, fish arrowheads, or lures, maybe. And when he finally finished again, he had cleaned away the whole side and top of the fuselage that stuck out of the water, had cut down into the water as far as he could reach, and had a hole almost as big as he was, except that it was crossed and crisscrossed with aluminum, or it might be steel, he couldn't tell, braces and formers and cables. It was an awful tangled mess, but after chopping some braces away, there was room for him to wiggle through and get inside. He held back for a moment, uncomfortable with the thought of getting inside the plane. What if the tail settled back to the bottom and he got caught and couldn't get out? It was a horrible thought. But then he reconsidered. The thing had been up now for 2 days, plus a bit, and he had been hammering and climbing on it, and it hadn't gone back down. It seemed pretty solid. He eeled in through the cables and formers, wiggling and pulling until he was inside the tail with his head clear of the surface of the water and his legs down on the angled floor. When he was ready, he took a deep breath and pushed down along the floor with his legs, feeling for some kind of fabric or cloth, anything with his bare feet. He touched nothing but the floor plates. Up, a new breath, then he reached down to formers underwater and pulled himself beneath the water, his legs pushing down and down almost to the backs of the front seats, and finally, on the left side of the plane, he thought he felt his foot hit cloth or canvas. Up for more air, deep breathing, then one more grab at the formers, and pushing as hard as he could, he jammed his feet down and he hit it again, definitely canvas or heavy nylon. And this time when he pushed his foot, he thought he felt something inside it, something hard. It had to be the bag. Driven forward by the crash, it was jammed into the backs of the seats and caught on something. He tried to reach for it and pull, but didn't have the air left and went up for more. Lungs filled in great gulps, he shot down again, pulling on the formers until he was almost there. Then wheeling down head first, he grabbed at the cloth. It was the survival bag. He pulled and tore at it to loosen it, and just as it broke free and his heart leaped to feel it rise, he looked up, above the bag. In the light coming through the side window, the pale green light from the water, he saw the pilot's head, only it wasn't the pilot's head any longer. The fish. He'd never really thought of it, but the fish. The fish he had been eating all this time had to eat, too. They had been at the pilot all this time, almost 2 months, nibbling and chewing, and all that remained was the not-quite-cleaned skull, and when he looked up, it wobbled loosely. Too much. Too much. His mind screamed in horror, and he slammed back and was sick in the water. Sick so that he choked on it and tried to breathe water and could have ended there. Ended with the pilot where it almost ended when they first arrived, except that his legs jerked. It was instinctive. Fear more than anything else. Fear of what he had seen. But they jerked and pushed, and he was headed up when they jerked, and he shot to the surface, still inside the birdcage of formers and cables. His head slammed into a bracket as he cleared, and he reached up to grab it and was free, in the air, hanging up in the tail. He hung that way for several minutes, choking and heaving and gasping for air, fighting to clear the picture of the pilot from his mind. It went slowly. He knew it would never completely leave, but he looked to the shore, and there were trees and birds. The sun was getting low and golden over his shelter, and when he stopped coughing, he could hear the gentle sounds of evening, the peace sounds, the bird sounds, and the breeze in the trees. The peace finally came to him, and he settled his breathing. He was still a long way from being finished, had a lot of work to do. The bag was floating next to him, but he had to get it out of the plane and onto the raft, then back to shore. He wiggled out through the formers, it seemed harder than when he came in, and pulled the raft around. The bag fought him. It was almost as if it didn't want to leave the plane. He pulled and jerked, and still it wouldn't fit, and at last he had to change the shape of it, rearranging what was inside by pushing and pulling at the sides until he had narrowed it and made it longer. Even when it finally came, it was difficult, and he had to pull first at one side, then another, an inch at a time, squeezing it through. All of this took some time, and when he finally got the bag out and tied on top of the raft, it was nearly dark. He was bone-tired from working in the water all day, chilled deep, and he still had to push the raft to shore. Many times he thought he would not make it. With the added weight of the bag, which seemed to get heavier by the foot, coupled with the fact that he was getting weaker all the time, the raft seemed barely to move. He kicked and pulled and pushed, taking the shortest way straight back to shore, hanging to rest many times, then surging again and again. It seemed to take forever. And when at last his feet hit bottom and he could push against the mud and slide the raft into the shore weeds to bump against the bank, he was so weak he couldn't stand, had to crawl, so tired he didn't even notice the mosquitoes that tore into him like a gray, angry cloud. He had done it. That's all he could think now. He had done it. He turned and sat on the bank with his legs in the water and pulled the bag ashore and began the long drag. He couldn't lift it, back down the shoreline to his shelter. 2 hours, almost three, he dragged and stumbled in the dark, brushing the mosquitoes away, sometimes on his feet, more often on his knees, finally to drop across the bag and to sleep when he made the sand in front of the doorway. He had done it. Treasure. Unbelievable riches. He could not believe the contents of the survival pack. The night before, he was so numb with exhaustion he couldn't do anything but sleep. All day in the water had tired him so much that in the end he had fallen asleep sitting against his shelter wall, oblivious even to the mosquitoes, to the night, to anything. But with false gray dawn, he had awakened instantly and began to dig in the pack, to find amazing, wonderful things. There was a sleeping bag, which he hung to dry over his shelter roof on the outside, and foam sleeping pad. An aluminum cook set with 4 little pots and 2 frying pans. It actually even had a fork and knife and spoon. A waterproof container with matches and 2 small butane lighters. A sheath knife with a compass in the handle. As if a compass would help him, he thought, smiling. A first aid kit with bandages and tubes of antiseptic paste and small scissors. A cap that said Cessna across the front in large letters. Why a cap, he wondered. It was adjustable, and he put it on immediately. A fishing kit with 4 coils of line, 12 small lures and hooks and sinkers. Incredible wealth. It was like all the holidays in the world, all the birthdays there were. He sat in the sun by the doorway where he had dropped the night before and pulled the presents, as he thought of them, out one at a time to examine them, turn them in the light, touch them, and feel them with his hands and eyes. Something that at first puzzled him. He pulled out what seemed to be the broken-off bulky stock of a rifle, and he was going to put it aside, thinking it might be for something else in the pack, when he shook it and it rattled. After working at it a moment, he found the butt of the stock came off, and inside there was a barrel and magazine and action assembly with a clip and a full box of 50 shells. It was a .22 survival rifle. He had seen one once in the sporting goods store where he went for bike parts, and the barrel screwed onto the stock. He had never owned a rifle, never fired one, but had seen them on television, of course, and after a few moments figured out how to put it together by screwing the action onto the stock, how to load it and put the clip full of bullets into the action. There was a strange feeling holding the rifle. It somehow removed him from everything around him. Without the rifle, he had to fit in, to be part of it all, to understand it and use it, the woods, all of it. With the rifle, suddenly, he didn't have to know, did not have to be afraid or understand. He didn't have to get close to a fool bird to kill it, didn't have to know how it would stand if he didn't look at it and moved off to the side. The rifle changed him. The minute he picked it up, and he wasn't sure he liked the change very much. He set it aside, leaning it carefully against the wall. He could deal with that feeling later. The fire was out, and he used a butane lighter and a piece of birch bark with small twigs to get another one started, marveling at how easy it was, but feeling again that the lighter somehow removed him from where he was, what he had to know. With a ready flame, he didn't have to know how to make a spark nest or how to feed the new flames to make them grow. As with the rifle, he wasn't sure he liked the change. Up and down, he thought. The pack was wonderful, but it gave him up and down feelings. With the fire going and sending up black smoke and a steady roar from a pitch-smelling chunk he put on, he turned once more to the pack. Rummaging through the food packets, he hadn't brought them out yet because he wanted to save them until last, glory in them. He came up with a small electronic device completely encased in a plastic bag. At first he thought it was a radio or cassette player, and he had a surge of hope because he missed music, missed sound, missed hearing another voice. But when he opened the plastic and took the thing out and turned it over, he could see that it wasn't a receiver at all. There was a coil of wire held together on the side by tape, and it sprung into a 3-foot-long antenna when he took the tape off. No speaker, no lights, just a small switch at the top, and on the bottom he finally found in small print, "Emergency transmitter." That was it. He turned the switch back and forth a few times, but nothing happened. He couldn't even hear static. So, as with the rifle, he set it against the wall and went back to the bag. It was probably ruined in the crash, he thought. 2 bars of soap. He had bathed regularly in the lake, but not with soap, and he thought how wonderful it would be to wash his hair. Thick with grime and smoke dirt, frizzed by wind and sun, matted with fish and foolbird grease, his hair had grown and stuck and tangled and grown until it was a clumped mess on his head. He could use the scissors from the first aid kit to cut it off, then wash it with soap. And then finally, the food. It was all freeze-dried and in such quantity that he thought, with this I could live forever. Package after package he took out. Beef dinner with potatoes, cheese and noodle dinners, chicken dinners, egg and potato breakfasts, fruit mixes, drink mixes, dessert mixes, more dinners and breakfasts than he could count easily, dozens and dozens of them all packed in waterproof bags, all in perfect shape, and when he had them all out and laid against the wall in stacks, he couldn't stand it, and he went through them again. If I'm careful, he thought, they'll last as long as I need them to last. If I'm careful. No, not yet. I won't be careful just yet. First, I'm going to have a feast. Right here and now, I'm going to cook up a feast and eat until I drop, and then I'll be careful. He went into the food packs once more and selected what he wanted for his feast. A 4-person beef and potato dinner with orange drink for an appetizer and something called a peach whip for dessert. Just add water, it said on the packages, and cook for 30 minutes or so until everything was normal size and done. Brian went to the lake and got water in one of the aluminum pots and came back to the fire. Just that amazed him, to be able to carry water to the fire in a pot. Such a simple act, and he hadn't been able to do it for almost 2 months. He guessed at the amounts and put the beef dinner and peach dessert on to boil, then went back to the lake and brought water to mix with the orange drink. It was sweet and tangy, almost too sweet, but so good that he didn't drink it fast, held it in his mouth and let the taste go over his tongue, tickling on the sides, sloshing it back and forth and then down, swallow, then another. That, he thought, that is just fine, just fine. He got more lake water and mixed another one and drank it fast, then a third one, and he sat with that near the fire, but looking out across the lake, thinking how rich the smell was from the cooking beef dinner. There was garlic in it, and some other spices, and the smells came up to him and made him think of home, his mother cooking, the rich smells of the kitchen. And at that precise instant, with his mind full of home and the smell from the food filling him, the plane appeared. He had only a moment of warning. There was a tiny drone, but as before, it didn't register. Then suddenly, roaring over his head, low and in back of the ridge, a bush plane with floats fairly exploded into his life. It passed directly over him, very low, tipped a wing sharply over the tail of the crashed plane in the lake, cut power, glided down the long part of the L of the lake, then turned and glided back, touching the water gently once, twice, and settling with a spray to taxi and stop, with its floats gently bumping the beach in front of Brian's shelter. He had not moved. It had all happened so fast that he hadn't moved. He sat with the pot of orange drink still in his hand, staring at the plane, not quite understanding it yet, not quite knowing yet that it was over. The pilot cut the engine, opened the door and got out, balanced, and stepped forward on the float to hop onto the sand without getting his feet wet. He was wearing sunglasses and he took them off to stare at Brian. "I heard your emergency transmitter, then I saw the plane when I came over." He trailed off, cocked his head, studying Brian. "Damn. You're him, aren't you? You're that kid. They quit looking almost 2 months ago. You're him, aren't you? You're that kid." Brian was standing now, but still silent, still holding the drink. His tongue seemed to be stuck to the roof of his mouth, and his throat didn't work right. He looked at the pilot and the plane and down at himself, dirty and ragged, burned and lean and tough, and he coughed to clear his throat. "My name is Brian Robeson," he said. Then he saw that his stew was done, the peach whip almost done, and he waved to it with his hand. "Would you like something to eat?" The pilot who landed so suddenly in the lake was a fur buyer mapping Cree trapping camps for future buying runs, drawn by Brian when he unwittingly turned on the emergency transmitter and left it going. The Cree move into the camps for fall and winter to trap, and the buyers fly from camp to camp on a regular route. When the pilot rescued Brian, he had been alone on the L-shaped lake for 54 days. During that time, he had lost 17% of his body weight. He later gained back 6%, but had virtually no body fat. His body had consumed all extra weight, and he would remain lean and wiry for several years. Many of the changes would prove to be permanent. Brian had gained immensely in his ability to observe what was happening and react to it. That would last him all his life. He had become more thoughtful as well, and from that time on he would think slowly about something before speaking. Food, all food, even food he did not like, never lost its wonder for him. For years after his rescue, he would find himself stopping in grocery stores to just stare at the aisles of food, marveling at the quantity and the variety. There were many questions in his mind about what he had seen and known, and he worked at research when he got back, identifying the game and berries. Gut cherries were termed choke cherries and made good jelly. The nut bushes where the fool birds hid were hazelnut bushes. The two kinds of rabbits were snowshoes and cottontails. The fool birds were ruffed grouse, also called fool hens by trappers for their stupidity. The small food fish were bluegills, sunfish, and perch. The turtle eggs were laid by a snapping turtle, as he had thought. The wolves were timber wolves, which are not known to attack or bother people. The moose was a moose. There were also the dreams. He had many dreams about the lake after he was rescued. The Canadian government sent a team in to recover the body of the pilot, and they took reporters, who naturally took pictures and film of the whole campsite, the shelter, all of it. For a brief time, the press made much of Brian, and he was interviewed for several networks, but the Führer died within a few months. A writer showed up who wanted to do a book on the complete adventure, as he called it, but he turned out to be a dreamer, and it all came to nothing but talk. Still, Brian was given copies of the pictures and tape, and looking at them seemed to trigger the dreams. They were not nightmares. None of them were frightening. But he would awaken at times with them, just awaken and sit up and think of the lake, the forest, the fire at night, the night birds singing, the fish jumping. Sit in the dark alone and think of them, and it was not bad, and would never be bad for him. Predictions are, for the most part, ineffective. But it might be interesting to note that had Brian not been rescued when he was, had he been forced to go into hard fall, perhaps winter, it would have been very rough on him. When the lake froze, he would have lost the fish. And when the snow got deep, he would have had trouble moving at all. Game becomes seemingly plentiful in the fall. It's easier to see with the leaves off the brush. But in winter it gets scarce, and sometimes simply non-existent, as predators, fox, lynx, wolf, owls, weasels, fisher, marten, northern coyote, sweep through areas and wipe things out. It's amazing what a single owl can do to a local population of ruffed grouse and rabbits in just a few months. After the initial surprise and happiness from his parents at his being alive, for a week it looked as if they might actually get back together, things rapidly went back to normal. His father returned to the northern oil fields where Brian eventually visited him, and his mother stayed in the city, worked at her career in real estate, and continued to see the man in the station wagon. Brian tried several times to tell his father, came really close once to doing it, but in the end never said a word about the man or what he knew. The secret. This is Peter Coyote. We hope you've enjoyed this Dell production of Hatchet by Gary Paulson. This program was produced by Blaine and DeRosa Productions. Production copyright 1992. Bantam Audio Publishing, all rights reserved. Available soon from Bantam Audio, The River, the sequel to Hatchet.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.